The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm a producer and editor here in the Free Library's author events office, and I'm very pleased to be here to introduce tonight's guests. In 2012, Maria Kefalas's daughter, Calliope, was diagnosed with a rare, degenerative, and incurable genetic disease called metachromatic leukodystrophy. Rather than succumbing to grief, Kefalas and her husband harness this powerful emotion in order to save other children and ultimately themselves and others. What followed was an incredible odyssey that included a fundraising bake sale of more than 50,000 cupcakes, a blog that blossomed into articles published in the likes of Slate and in the Huffington Post, two groundbreaking charitable foundations, and advocacy in America's loftiest halls of power. A sociology professor at St. Joseph's University, Kefalas is the author of the books Hollowing Out the Middle, Working Class Heroes, and Promises I Can Keep. She tells her and her family's story heartbreakingly and ultimately inspiringly in her latest book, Harnessing Grief, A Mother's Quest for Meaning and Miracles, which she brings to us here tonight. In it, she illustrates, quote, with fierce love and unexpected humor, the power of grief to transform and motivate a warrior mother to change the world. Tonight, Maria will be in conversation with Ashley Fox, whose 24-year career in sports media includes a long stint as an NFL lead reporter and analyst at ESPN. She has also written about and reported on a very wide array of other sports for that venerable network, and is also an athlete, inspirational speaker, a mother, and an entrepreneur. Maria, Ashley, we'd really like to thank you for being here tonight, and please take it away.
Thank you. And you can add to this list of things that I do. I'm like Maria's number one fan. So I'm just going to put this out here at the beginning. I have no objectivity when it comes to my friend. She is amazing. We had the great pleasure of meeting 16 years ago when our kids were in nursery school together. And she is the most... she's like a superhero. She's powerful and strong and smart and beautiful and so very dear. And so I just love her to death. I'm so honored to be here to have a conversation with her.
I thought we said no crying. Don't make me cry in the intro.
I know, sorry. I feel like I'm gonna cry. I was at your house, Maria, when Callie and my son Austin were babies. And I remember sitting there and you told a story about how the conversation went with you and Pat and PJ and Camille when you told the kids that you were pregnant. And PJ's reaction, if I'm not mistaken, was, I thought you said you were too old to get pregnant. And Pat, in the way only Pat could say, his response was, we are. And I'll never forget that. Can you just explain what has happened since then?
Wow. So I always go back to the moment, the day we brought home Cal from the hospital on Christmas Day of 2009. And my dad was there. We had just bought this house, which I was in love with, this crazy 120-year-old tutor. And Pat and I had these great jobs and we had these three kids, and somehow I'd gotten through being pregnant at 42, and it was the easiest pregnancy. And I remember sitting in the hospital thinking, it was Christmas morning, my life is perfect. And I had maybe this is retrospect, this nagging sense, well, what's gonna happen now? Because my life is perfect. I have this great family, I have this great husband, I have this great career. And then in 2012, it just is gone. I mean, it's first my husband, Pat, was diagnosed with multiple myeloma. On the day he's beginning chemo at Penn, he gets a call from Ireland. His father has pancreatic cancer. And then 3 months later, my dad gets diagnosed with stage 3 bladder cancer. And I'm thinking, okay, it can't get any worse. It can't get any worse. And we're done, right? And then in July of 2012, we go to CHOP. And in a book, in a story chronicled in the book, they say she's got this ultra rare disease. Pat and I were carriers, we had no idea, and that she's gonna die in 3 years. And I remember literally trying to see if I could jump out the window of the ninth floor of CHOP. I mean, it had gone from the best place to the worst place in, you know, less than 3 years. And it was astounding, even now thinking about it.
Mm. You write in the book about, you said, those first days home, I felt like I was dying. And years later, I would realize that I was. The person I once was, the person who looked forward to sending her daughter to kindergarten or teaching her to swim in the ocean, ceased to exist. A mother's dreams for the future are inextricably linked to her sense of self, and human beings who have nothing to look forward to become zombies, stumbling through life and missing the defining feature of their humanity, hope.
Yeah,
I mean, how did you go from that to this?
You know, so the book chronicles the first kind of 2 years of the multi-year nervous breakdown. And, you know, I describe it like a light flickering on and off, and that some, you know, the first couple weeks after we found out Cal was sick. I mean, I hearing your husband, your 43-year-old husband has cancer is really bad. But hearing your 2-year-old's going to die is a whole other level of horror. And, you know, it was like Pat and I were these two people drowning side by side, and you just had to sort of go under. And I realized that what was grief, what was the sense of dying, was literally this old person being burned away and this new person being coming in, you know, this transformation. And I came to believe that Cal was being transformed into a mermaid. That was easier for, I really believe that she was becoming this magical creature. I refused to accept that she was dying. And, you know, you just kind of, at some point, I don't think I ever really resisted the insanity of it all and the breakdown. And I just like walked right into it. And much to my amazement, after a really long time, I was still there. And I started to feel alive again a little bit. And I realized, I think very early on, but it didn't become kind of a fully formed action plan until about a year later, when I saw that the only way to save ourselves was to help other people. And I'm not sure how I got there. And when I talk to families now, I'm like, I don't tell them that right away, but sometimes they wake up to that on their own. But I do tell them that if anyone can get through this like me, then they can. And the fact that they're actually having a conversation with me is a really good sign, because I couldn't even talk. I mean, I couldn't even function on that level. So it is really an extraordinary experience. And then you realize that after the worst thing happens, you can do anything. And so I'm not fearless, but there's nothing left to fear. I always say, like, I there's nothing else that can scare me after that.
What did her diagnosis do to your family dynamic? I mean, and your marriage? I mean, you and Pat were vastly different human beings. How did that, what was that like?
You know, I think that, you know, this is really hard on marriages. And I don't think most couples react to the shock in the same way. And Pat had this very stoic style, as you know, knowing him really well. He was someone who cried in all of the years, even as he was dying of cancer. He never complained. He only cried once, and he shut it down. Mm-hmm. And his instinct was to protect everyone. And so he didn't tell his parents about his cancer the day they called and told him, which was still to this day extraordinary that he wanted. His instinct was to protect everyone else and maybe protect himself, but mostly protect everyone else. I, on the other hand, had a full blown, you know, I was like screaming at the top of my lungs. He turned it all in and I was screaming at the top of my lungs. I was, you know, he would insist that I go out in public and, you know, make sure that I was, you know, brushing my hair and not wearing my pajamas. But he, you know, I embraced the complete meltdown of it. And it was hard because he was someone who, you know, found my style difficult and painful, but he loved me enough to put up with it. And that was always hard for him because I think he, maybe on some level he was jealous that I could be so emotional, but at the same time, I think his instinct was just to keep it all in. He said that right before he died, he wrote this essay and he talked about how, you know, for the Irish, you know, suppressing emotion is an art form and I can't change now. Even as he was dying, right till the end.
Wow. One of the things that, I mean, I love this book and I will brag that I've been in on the ground floor. So I'm fully vested and I'm in it. So that's very exciting for me. Thank you very much. But one of the things that I think is so remarkable about, there's a lot remarkable about it, but is your ability to have a sense of humor through all of the turmoil and tragedy and sadness. And it's really, I mean, it's self-deprecating humor too, which is really funny. I mean, you write that your sister advised you were having insomnia and your sister advised you to take walks. And so you write, "It was summer, so I would take strolls through the neighborhood late at night, wearing my pajamas and flip-flops, no bra, and my curly hair wild. I became a ghost haunting my old life as a mainline soccer mom." And you talk about, like, you list a top 10 reasons why you know you're screwed, like how you know you're screwed. And one of them was you wish it was a brain tumor. Yeah. And another one was your shrink tells you, "I've got nothing for you." How?
Actually, he used stronger language. He used much stronger language.
Well, I hope so. How have you been able to maintain your sense of humor? Like, where does that come from?
I have no idea. I mean, I think that I could always see the absurdity in it. And, you know, when I was writing the book and I would read other memoirs, I was always a little skeptical and confused and maybe jealous about the women who could be, you know, so self-possessed, sort of like the Jackie Onassis kind of trope of grief, you know, beautiful and stoic and just, you know, you know, just behind the sunglasses and mysterious. And, you know, I suspected that this was done through, you know, drugs and alcohol, but however, you know, this like incredibly controlled, managed version of grief. And I'd never understood that. I just felt like a mess. And I felt like this is kind of funny. You know, I think that just kind of came through. And Pat used to think my essays, you know, he would tease me because I would say, "Don't you think this is funny?" And he would say, "No, I don't think any of this is funny." But I certainly could see the absurdity in it. And I could see the absurdity in me. And a lot of people have really reacted to the fact that they feel very validated that the heroic mom character, who, you know, is supposed to be stoic and fight to the bitter end to their for their kids, is allowed to be, you can do that, but also be a hot mess and funny and, you know, just not take yourself very seriously. And I think that was, that has been the thing. So many people have written me about the book. I've been amazed by the response to the book. And so many people write to me and they say, thank you for getting that right. I didn't know how, even how to put that into words. It was like this secret about moms like us.
Yeah, well, it's real. And we're not Jackie O.
No, I don't know how Jackie O did that. I mean, honestly, like, you know, I began to study people, as you know, Ashley. I became obsessed with people who had had incredible grief happen to them. And I became obsessed with meeting Joe Biden. And, you know, I read about Stephen Colbert and how his family had endured the loss of his father and brothers. And so I was like, you know, as an academic and as an ethnographer, I became like this participant observer of people who had been through horrible tragedies. And I kept trying to figure out how to do it. And, you know, and it's still a quest today, but I feel like I found, at least in writing this book, my answer to the question of how you do it.
You write about the superpower of grief. When did you come up with that term?
That was something that came to me, I think, by the first year after Cal's diagnosis, in terms of when Dr. Waldman and the doctors at CHOP, who, big shout out, a bunch of them are listening. I love you guys, CHOP. CHOP is amazing. I know that some of them are like listening from the floor, but I think that when we started to see the breakthroughs in the field, when we saw gene therapy was, you know, was not gonna happen in 20 years, it was gonna happen in a year, you know, and I met the first family and I met the first child who had been impacted by this disease, but also been treated. I had kind of initially thought I really couldn't do it. I thought I'm not brave enough. I'm too selfish. I can't do it. And it was my friends like, you know, the amazing Liz Scott and Dr. Waldman who said, of course you are, of course you're gonna do this. Of course you're gonna help them. And I wasn't sure. And then I met the first family, the Prices, who I describe in the book, Giovanni Price. And as soon as Amy Price sent me a picture of Giovanni, and I, like I said, I have that picture saved in my phone. As soon as I saw Giovanni and I saw him, you know, playing miniature golf, and I saw how sick Cal was and how playing miniature golf was supposed to be impossible, that was it. I was in. And I said, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. And I haven't stopped. And it still surprises me that I reacted that way. But as soon as I saw those children, it did not cause me jealousy or regret. I was saved. And I thought, I am so lucky. I often say I'm like the luckiest unlucky person in the world. Because, you know, my girl is sick. My husband had cancer. Things have not gone very well. But at the same time, I've seen amazing things. And I'm always trapped by the paradox that the world is better because of Cal. I don't want this to have happened to her, but the world is better because of Cal and everything that's happened. So I'm like always trapped in that feedback loop that her, you know, everything that's happened has been so amazing. But again, I wouldn't wish it to have happened in the first place.
How is Callie?
Callie is really good. She is 6 years beyond her life expectancy. And at this point at CHOP, you know, we joke like Cal hasn't read any of the medical journal articles. She doesn't seem to care what the experts had predicted. And, you know, when Pat died, he was really worried about her. And I feel like he didn't believe in the afterlife, but I really believe that he willed himself to protect her. I mean, I honestly believe that he would have might have lived longer, except that he gave her every bit of strength he had, and he literally sacrificed himself to get. So, I mean, she's actually been better than it's, I mean, her respiratory health is better. Her appetite is better. I can't even believe I'm saying that. It doesn't make any sense at all. Her doctor is a chop. They're like, we don't know. We are in uncharted territory at this point, but we're grateful and we're amazed and really lucky. Really lucky.
How, for those who don't know, Pat died in March?
April
6th. I was there when we did like the parade memorial service in our cars because of COVID, and losing someone in this time obviously is rough. How have you gotten through it?
Oh, I don't think I have any choice. The kids have been amazing. My older children are much more naturally brave than I am. And we have hunkered down. And my oldest daughter is so funny and so smart. And she loves to give me advice on everything from my diet and to, you know, sleeping and taking better care of myself and, you know, work. So she was really big on me running. She's been really big on me not eating junk food. My daughter and I got tattoos together, which is, so, I mean, grief in the time of COVID results in cool, you know, tattoos with your 20-year-old daughter. PJ and I, you know, we hang out together and, you know, he misses his dad so much. And yet I feel like I have this, like, these two warriors who protect me, and they're really amazing. And Cal and I think we're both more emotional about Pat's death, and she's really mourned his loss. Like, she became more quiet. She didn't laugh as much. She absolutely misses him and knows he's gone. And I think she's just kind of pissed about it. She's just really angry, which is kind of how I am. So I think her experience of grief is really actually kind of more pure. The kids are like trying to protect me. The older kids are trying to protect me, but I think she's like, where is he and what happened to him? And, you know, someone fix this. And I've talked to her a lot about it, and she's been doing better though. She laughs more again. She's doing a little better.
Have you experienced any survivor's guilt?
How so?
Like, he's gone.
No, I'm actually kind of jealous. Sometimes, like, when something really horrible happens, I'm thinking, why did you leave me to deal with this? And no. I mean, he was like, oh, he fought so hard. I mean, I don't believe, you know, he fought so hard, and it was just, it was too much. It was just too much. And to see someone that, you know, kind of beautiful and strong, the only thing he worried about was Cal. Mm-hmm. Till the bitter end, you know, he kept saying, gosh, you know, I can accept this, but I can't think about leaving you guys. And he, you know, had everything taken care of, and he had, you know, it all figured out to make sure the kids were okay and I was okay. And to this day, I mean, it was much worse than he was letting on. He was trying to protect me till the bitter end. And, you know, he was like, oh, you know, it's, there, you know, we're going to try a new medication. It's going to be okay. They haven't given up yet. And yet he was like secretly liquidating stocks and writing down a spreadsheet for me and telling me what, you know, giving me orders and planning his funeral. And because of course Pat would plan his own funeral. He was that kind of a person. He was like, okay, this is how it's going to be. Long list of directions and orders for me.
Back to something you said a minute ago. How do you know that Callie's pissed? Like, how?
Oh,
can you tell?
I think one of the inaccuracies. If you look up MLD, it says the children have dementia and that they're in a vegetative state. And I've always talked to the doctors and I've said, that's not true. When she could, by the sound of his footsteps, she knew it was him. She would like literally lift her body because she could tell by the way he walked that it was him. And she would start smiling and singing and cooing as soon as he came up the steps. And she just doesn't do that anymore. And she's happy to see me, but that kind of joy and smiling that she did for him, she doesn't do it anymore. She doesn't do it anymore.
What have you told her?
I told her that Daddy had to go, that he can't come back, and that he didn't want to go, and that, you know, we're going to be okay. And you know, she knows he's not here and he's not coming back.
Did you tell him he died or not?
I didn't use the word died. Actually, I never used the word died. I just said he's not coming back. I've never used that word around her. I use that word a lot, but I'm not around her. I don't know what she understands about death, but she does understand people going and leaving, going and not coming back. I explained it, her father's absence as that absence, as opposed to death. And she understands that. She understands.
You said something to me the other night that I had not thought of and was very moved by, that you said that you think that, or you know, that Pat's waiting for her.
No, I have never said that to her. Sometimes I get scared that she's not doing well. And sometimes I think he's waiting for her. And he misses her so much that he wants her to come with him. I mean, I don't think she, I've always said to her, you have to go when you're ready. And she's not ready yet. She's not ready yet. That she understands. I said that to her since she was two. And I said, you'll tell me when you're ready, right? But she's not done yet, Ashley. I mean, she's not done yet. She is not finished yet. Her body is like so delicate. I mean, even her doctors are sometimes like afraid to touch her because she's so delicate. She's like this little, she fractured her leg simply by lifting her leg and getting it caught in the sheets of the bed. She's that delicate. She's like a little baby bird, and yet she doesn't want to go yet. She's not finished. And she knows is that people love her. I know people find this amazing, like, you know, she doesn't leave the house and we don't go out, but she's really happy still. She's still very loved, and like, she's downstairs with her nurse right now, who's a retired nurse, Renee, and you know, Renee is amazing. Like, Renee, everyone kind of runs to hold her because like holding her is like magic. Like when you hold Cal, your heart rate slows down and you just feel better. You just feel, it's like a really good yoga class or something, or it's like having a really nice glass of wine. I don't know how else to describe it. She just slows you down and she gets you focused, and she's amazing that way. And so like everyone kind of fights to hold her. Her nurses always like snuggle with her all day long. I mean, she's just like pure love. I mean, she doesn't talk. All she is like love. All she is love. All she does is give it and receive it. That's her whole existence. And she's not done yet. It's remarkable.
You've been very steadfast in not looking back at pre-diagnosis Cal. from the jump, you have been very, very much that you weren't going to look back. Have you, in the middle of the night or whenever, have you looked forward at all? Yeah. Or are you staying in the...
You to do this, you have to have no past and no future. No past, no future. You don't look back, you don't look forward. Because the anticipatory grief about what was supposed to be or what's going to happen would kill you. And you can get either trapped in the past or terrified by the future. And I don't do it. I don't do self-pity. I mean, I scream, which is like strange. I've explained this many times to people. I scream and yell at the top of my lungs all the time. I get upset and I cry and I write crazy blogs and I, you know, do insane things on a regular basis, but I never feel sorry for myself because Cal, and I've told this to the kids too. I'm like, Cal doesn't feel sorry for herself. She's not complaining. We don't get to complain. And, you know, it is, I mean, that's what I think, you know, people meant when they said, if you can, you know, really be present in the life of a child like Cal, she's going to teach you the meaning of life. And that's what, isn't that kind of like mindfulness, right? It's to live with no past, no future, to live in the present, you know, which sounds kind of easy, but it's not. It's not easy at all. And to be grateful for what's possible and to be grateful that, okay, it was a great day today. Cal slept through the night. I'm not in the CHOP ER. You know, for me, that's a really good day. Now, most people would not say, oh, that's not a really exceptionally good day. Every day I'm not in the hospital. Every day Cal's breathing okay. Every day Cal gets through a feed. Every day Cal can, you know, that her nurses are here and I get through another day of work and the kids are okay. Every day she's here with us is a good day. And I just remember being this, you know, mainline mom, right, who wanted a career and a nicer house and a vacation house, you know, at the shore, whatever. And all of that, like, is so, I don't understand how normal people live. I don't understand how normal people, you know, get annoyed with their kid because, you know, they didn't make the travel team or something. I don't understand any of that. I'm just like, I'm home. She's here. I'm so relieved. This is not the day that I have completely, absolutely put aside. But I also had the gift of, you know, telling our story. I really believe that telling your story tames grief. And I think that's, I started writing about, you remember, Ashley, because you were like the crazy ass blog. I mean, I started writing the blog, I think about 2 months after her diagnosis. And I shared it with a couple of friends and it was really helpful. And then people, to this day, no one's exactly sure why people liked the crazy ass blog. And maybe you know why people liked it. I don't know. People still like, they miss the blog. And my agent said, when I sold the book, she's like, you can't write the blog anymore. You got to save it for the book. So I stopped writing the blog. People were like, I miss the blog. I said, really? You do? I don't know.
I miss the blog too.
Well, it's here in the book. It's here in the book now.
I mean, and this is awesome. But this, for those of you who weren't privy to the crazy ass blog, this is a very tamed down version of the crazy ass blog. Which kind of brings me to another question. You know, writing a memoir is a really difficult thing to do. And I know the crazy ass blog started your process, but how did you find your voice? How did you do it?
It took a long time. It took 6 years to find my voice. And when I originally wrote the book, I thought it would be about Cal's death.
Right.
And then I'm like, you know, I think 3 years into it, I said, well, this is not about Cal's death. Cal is not dying and that's not what's happening here. And I actually resisted. I've only recently acknowledged that I'm a memoirist. I actually hated the label. I found memoir, first off, like, you know, I'm no Joan Didion. And that used to kind of freak me out. I'd be like, well, you know, I would read Joan Didion's memoir on, you know, her version of this. And I was, this is really depressing. I'll never write this beautifully. And my agent said, stop. My agent, Lisa Adams, hi, Lisa, always kept saying, stop reading Joan Didion. You're not Joan Didion. So once I kind of let go of, okay, I'm not Joan Didion, and I need to write this in a tone that isn't too scary for the reader, because the Crazy Ass Blog, the original version, was really terrifying. It was like being on this roller coaster that was about to collapse or something. And so as I was getting the voice, I was like, I rewrote the story with more guardrails on for the reader to let them know that I was in fact okay, because it was just too much. And then I realized that the story, which is the hard part of writing memoir, is like, how do you create a set of nonlinear events and make them into a narrative arc, which we've talked about many times. Mm-hmm. So like, it became clear that it had to be about the crazy time, the really bad time, which is where the book focuses, I think, initially, and then to shift to this, the epiphany. The middle part is about this epiphany, superpower of grief. And then the last book part about the book is like what I did with it and what we were able to accomplish and the funny and crazy misadventures that resulted. But the first part of the book is about that breakdown and the metamorphosis and realizing that this thing that I thought was killing me was actually my new superpower, that I could change the world. And, you know, it was people like Liz Scott, who, you know, is the founder of Alex's Lemonade. And Liz came to me and has probably saved my life and talked me off a ledge and really very early on said, you know, you can help other people, you can help other children. And I wasn't ready, but she put that seed in there. And she says, like years later, she said, you know, I knew you could do it. And it was funny that people believed, like Julie Hershey at the Eagles, a Philadelphia treasure. She does the community outreach for the Eagles. She's a remarkable person. And Julie said to me, I've only met a handful of people that I think are, you know, just remarkable advocates. And one of them is Liz Scott. And you remind me of Liz Scott. And I was like, really? You do think I'm like Liz Scott? She's like, yeah, I do. And I believe that you can do it. And so here I am, you know? So people believed in me when I didn't, I guess, too. But the power of telling stories is really healing and transformative. It really is.
And that's why you did it.
That's why I did it.
Yeah.
I had to. I mean, it was like a physical thing. It was like coming out of me. It was just like, I remember thinking the writing was literally clawing its way out of me. And I thought, which is a writer, right? It's a very strange experience. I had written academic books. I loved writing, but I had never had a story that was like, you have to write this down. And you have to tell the story. And the first, you know, when I did a piece for the Slate and it went viral, I was sort of amazed because has ever gone viral. But yeah, it was amazing to sort of like have this kind of crazy ass blog and the truth that I saw there become something, and people like you and my agent Lisa Adams and my editor Gayatri Putnick at Beacon were like, there's something here, Maria, and it's beautiful and we believe in it. And so I'm really lucky that way. I'm so lucky that I get to talk about Cal and Pat with like all the people that are listening in. There's like over 100 people on this Zoom, which is amazing to me. This is amazing. So thank you everyone for tuning in and listening on a Tuesday night, on a cold Tuesday night in Philadelphia.
I know, it's really awesome. And so I could like hog and ask you questions the whole night. But I think what the plan is to open it up. If anybody has questions, pop them in the Q&A and I will relay them to Maria. And the first one comes from Dawn. She says, can you speak about how your education as a sociologist helped you understand your experiences and document them in the book?
Wow, okay, that's a great question. I wonder if Dawn's an academic. The Absolutely. I think I was much more comfortable thinking of myself as a sociologist of grief and doing participant observation like an anthropologist than a memoirist. And, Pat used to say that, and actually I think Lisa used to say this too, that there was like this instinct, there was this part of me that wanted to study it, like who kind of, my safe place was to sort of take a step back and study CHOP and study the doctors and study this whole experience of grief, the way absolutely you're trained as an anthropologist and a social scientist to do what's called participant observation, or ethnography. So that was the kind of, I mean, I studied low-income single moms in Philly by like hanging out with them. So I had this incredible world that I was now part of. I didn't want to be there, but I was now part of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. I was now part of this world of parents of terminally ill children. You know, I remember going up the floor past the oncology wing and thinking, gosh, I'm jealous of the pediatric cancer patients. And when you're like, I mean, that's an insane thing to feel like. I mean, you're like, gosh, I wish Cal had a brain tumor. And you just, and I said, well, this is, and so I would then sort of get to this other voice, well, this is fascinating, and start writing about that. And I found, you know, that this whole world amazing. And to get access to it, even though it was sort of an unwanted invitation, I was there, and there was a part of me that knew the value of telling that story. But it was weird. I was never comfortable writing about myself. That was strange, but also therapeutic. So yeah, absolutely. I think my training as an academic helped tremendously.
Okay, I'm going to skip around just a little bit, but we're going to get to everybody. This one comes from Amber Khan. She said, we recently received news of a human trial coming for AXD. And my daughter doesn't qualify. I'm determined to find a way to get her and others who don't qualify the treatment. What advice do you have for fellow Leuco moms who want to take action? Leuco being leukodystrophy, for those who don't know, who want to take action and help families as you have? It's a really important question.
Oh, it's a really important question, Amber. Hey, sweetie. Love to Jordan. I think that, you know, running clinical trials requires such tremendous sacrifice. And I understood, you know, with clarity that Cal would never benefit from the clinical trials I work with. I know, you know, the other families have different situations, and it's such an impossible kind of, hope it can be so cruel, and the expectation of, you know, holding on to the possibility of this, of treatment, and the fact that, you know, it will help some people and not your kid, and that these eligibility criterion, which seems so arbitrary. I mean, I feel like, you know, I don't have a really good answer to that. I just feel like I've learned that progress requires sacrifice, and, you know, I'm going to help you when we get off this talk, and I'm happy to talk to you about any of this and work with you on this. It's difficult. It's so difficult because the science requires these metrics, and it requires, you know, these incredible requests of the medical teams and the families. I mean, our medical trial for MLD, I always go back to that, required literally that the families lose one child for the chances to treat another one. It was the most, I mean, it was such an incredible burden on the medical team, on the families, on the children, that literally, you know, the families would save one kid and lose another. And I don't know. I mean, the progress comes at a tremendous price, and, you know, I'm here for you and I totally get it, but I don't think I have an answer beyond you just keep focusing on a way to help. And, you know, Cal always taught me that it was bigger than our family. I understood that, you know, pretty quickly. And it was all the kids who came after us and all the kids that came before. There was so much suffering and pain, and it was so hard to change it. But we'll talk more afterwards, Amber.
All right, this one comes from Lisa Sonnenborn. Hi, Lisa. She asks, how have your older children, PJ and Camille, been shaped by the experience of having a terminally ill sibling? And what advice would you give to other families who find themselves in a similar position?
Well, you know, I think that my children's childhood ended in 2012. They stopped being kids. When PJ was...
He was eight, right?
He was eight and Camille was 12. It was over. It was over. And, you know, the trauma of it is unavoidable. I keep apologizing to them about everything, how it happened, the childhoods that they didn't get to have. I also know that Cal has made them incredibly empathetic, incredibly wise. I mean, Camille is so smart. She was giving me this advice yesterday that was like so, a couple days ago, that was so clear-headed and so smart. And I was like, how are you 20 years old? I mean, so they have this incredible insight into the world that, you know, because their father and I couldn't protect them from like some fundamental truths. And Lisa understands this too, personally, like when parents can't, you know, trap you in the magical thinking of childhood, there is a sadness and cost to that, but they get really smart and really insightful. And, you know, they figure stuff out a lot faster than other kids do. And they're incredibly empathetic. So it's a terrible burden, but also a gift. Mm-hmm.
Well, they're great kids.
And they're great kids.
They're great.
They're like their dad. They're awesome. They're so, thank God they're like their dad, not like me. Camille's, Cal's like me. The other two, thank God they're like their father.
All right. This one comes from Christine Lowe. She said, how is it to be living in the present for Cal and thinking about time in the context of the rest of your family? Or is it inseparable? It's all about living in the present for PJ and Camille as well.
It's all about, like, we live in this time zone and we just orbit Cal. You know, Cal, like it or not, is the center of our universe. She's the sun and we're just orbiting around it, which is like really hard and unfair to the kids. Like I've lost track of all the Christmases and Thanksgivings and holidays and graduations that have been impacted by hospitalization, and I couldn't bring my daughter to college when she was a freshman. And, you know, I don't know how I'm gonna get to graduation for her next year. So it really stinks. I don't mean to suggest at all that, you know, it's all fabulous, but I do think that, you know, I don't remember my life before Cal's illness anymore, which is kind of scary. I kind of have to force myself to remember it. The kids occasionally remember being like other people, and they'll say to me, like, you remember that time, and remember when we used to go to the Cape, and remember. So they sort of like have this kind of wistful memory of their old life. But yeah, I think we've all kind of really trained ourselves, Christine, to be focused on what is possible in the now with this like really disciplined, unforgiving sort of way.
Interesting. Amber asks, what advice do you have for someone who is ready to tell their story? She said she's ready to tell hers and she's struggling with where to begin, which I'll tell you, Amber, Maria and I had this exact conversation on Saturday, because I too, for like 10 or 15 years, have been struggling with my book, and Maria just like laid it out for me in about 30 seconds and told me exactly where to start. So there you go.
Well, no, now you're gonna, no, well, you just start writing and I think that, you know, you start, the amazing thing about, you know, social media is that you can create your own blog. You can start submitting pieces to the Mighty, the Huffington Post. I mean, a lot of these forums are really open to, you know, not, you know, official professional writers. And memoir is really hard to publish. I mean, my agent, Lisa Adams, and don't call Lisa, she doesn't do memoirs. She's an amazing agent. Yeah, doesn't do memoirs, but because they're hard, although, you know, maybe you can choose that the Garamond and check her out. But I think that, you know, memoirs are really hard to sell, which I don't want to discourage you at all, but I think that, you know, the tough part that people told me about was, like, you have to figure out what your story is. You have to have your beginning, your middle, and your end. And Ashley, the only thing I did for Ashley's memoir project is I'm like, here's the beginning, the middle, and the end. She's like, oh, okay, that is the story. So you have to sort of like, you want to write about X experience, but how? What's the beginning, the middle, and the end? What is the, you know, where do you want to leave the writer, reader? And I mean, I think you just start writing. I'm a free writer, which, you know, is one process. My friend Ashley is a much more disciplined writer. She likes to, you know, I think she works with, you know, a kind of a more storyboard sort of style, you know, right? Like an outline style. So so you have to kind of also respect your process. So I'm just like verbal vomit, as my agent and editor will tell you. And they're like, I don't even want to read this. So you have to find your process. I also think it's worth working, when you get to a certain point, working with a professional editor. Another big plug for Will Myers, who is an independent, you know, freelancer out in Texas. He was like my midwife to write the book, but only at a certain point. Don't invest in an editor until you're ready. But like, if you start having, you know, a couple chapters, and you want to, you know, try to get it to the next level, and you're stuck, I mean, working with a foundational editor can be great. But, you know, again, you know, it's just about writing and just writing, and then it gets better and better and better.
All right. Well, here's a fascinating question to follow up with that. Dawn Apgar says, what are you writing now?
People have been stopping me in the store.
Can I go ahead. Real fast. The best part of being a writer is having written. So there you go.
Exactly. I have a couple ideas. I was on a strict word limit, actually. I mean, I could only do a certain number of words. I left a lot of stories on the editing floor, like my Joe Biden story. So I still have some material. I don't know. I mean, I keep thinking that every book I write is the last book. So I don't know. But I do. What if I start getting that urge to write again, I'll let you know. But if anyone has any ideas, people have been stopping me in the store giving me ideas, which is really funny. Like, you should write about X. And it's, I'm really touched that you think I could do that, but I don't know. We'll see.
You can.
Yeah.
All right. Sarah says, you speak with so much equanimity. It's a great word.
Great word.
Do you still have meltdown crazy times?
Oh gosh, yeah. I mean, there's still a lot of stuff I didn't include in the book. I mean, the book ends, you know, really in 2015. So there was a lot of other stuff that happened. And like I said, you know, my editor at Beacon was like, we're at a strict word limit. So I had to cut a lot of material out, which I think is good. I think no one said, I wish the book was longer. So yeah, I mean, is it about, you know, COVID is really kind of, I know a lot of people are gonna be writing about COVID, but, you know, what happened with Pat, you know, kind of gets at me. Grieving in the time of COVID really kind of gets to me. Being a widow, that's sort of funny. Being a widow is really funny. One of my neighbors came up to me right after Pat died. She's like, it's about to get really weird. And she was so right. She's like, it's about to get really weird. You have no idea. So widowhood is really funny. And I don't know. I think that I'm going to keep writing, but right now I'm just enjoying telling. I'm actually enjoying the storytelling. I'm really enjoying talking to people, because writing is, as writers know, really lonely. I mean, I didn't talk about this book for 7 years. I mean, a couple people had read it. So it's really exciting now to talk about it with folks.
I had a question in my head and now it just left me. So sorry about that. I guess the last thing that I'd like to ask is, if anybody has any more questions, please pop them in the chat. Oh wait, here's one from Courtney. Will you be writing another children's book?
Oh my gosh. My daughter wrote a children's book. I've written a couple children's books. My daughter wrote the best one yet. I don't know. I mean, that's a really good idea. I would love to write a children's book about this, about grief. But children's books are really hard to write. They're really tough to write. But yeah, I think it's a great idea. Thank you, Courtney.
I know you've gotten a lot of good advice throughout this process from people, real astute advice. What advice would you give, Maria, to people facing adversity, tragedy, despair, to help them get through it?
Oh, okay. Well, the advice I give people all the time, because I can't believe that I spend so much of my time talking to families like me, and that it doesn't frighten me, that it's actually really one of the more sustaining things I do. I just met a beautifully newly diagnosed family from Alabama who was here at CHOP. And, you know, my belief is really that these children are a gift, that your love is indestructible, that you're much braver than you realize, and that you don't need to actually feel brave, you just need to act brave. And that, you know, and that your kids, oh my gosh, no matter how flawed and how broken you are, they are like, they just love you. And Cal doesn't miss the life she was supposed to have because she has no concept of what that is. And that's what Father Peter meant when he said, you know, Cal will teach you the meaning of life. I mean, I just, God, did I see that? And the thing that killed me about that was like, why did Cal have to be sick for me to figure all this out? So a big part of writing this book was like, I hope I can share that with people without having to go through this. And I hope that if they have friends who go through this, God forbid this happens to someone you know or love, that you know how to help. And you understand what it's like without them having to explain it to you. Because I feel like my gift was my weird ability to be able to explain what was happening to me and describe it in real time.
Well, yeah, you became an expert on grief after being an expert on other things.
I mean, I think I'm an expert only because I could describe it and write it and analyze it. But yeah. But I can't believe it's 8:30.
Hold on. We got one more because Lisa asked a question that I should have asked you. Can you talk about, explain the button you're wearing?
Yes. This is my husband, Pat. And it says, what would Pat do? And this is the, Pat was like, you know, after he died, I was constantly thinking, what would Pat do in this situation? So a bunch of his students who miss him terribly and colleagues, I made this button for them because the thing about Pat was like, he always knew how to do the right thing. He always knew what the right thing to do was. He had this incredible sense and I miss him terribly. So when I'm in trouble, I'm like, what would Pat do, man? What would Pat do? I guess he would joke, it's like, what would Jesus do? But, but in lieu of that, he wasn't a big believer in that stuff. What would Pat do?
Well, he wouldn't have written the crazy ass blog.
He wouldn't have written the book. He wouldn't be doing this conversation. Pat would have said, right before he died, you know, people are shocked by this. He said, I love you. I'm really proud of you. It's almost a year to the day that he said this. I love you. I'm really proud of you because I finished the book on February 17th. He said, but I'm never going to read it. And people are like, oh, how could he say that? I said, well, because he said, listen, I was here for the first version. I saw it the first time. I don't need to be trapped in your head reliving it. So, and, but yeah, he would not be, yes, I shouldn't be wearing the button today doing a book tour talking about this because he would have this is not his style. But he was secretly jealous and he would have been really proud of me.
Of course he would. All right. Well, this has been amazing. I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did.
You guys. Thank you for coming.
The Follis.
Thank you, Ashley. Thank you, Free Library Philadelphia. This is amazing.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author events.